Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And of course, you know what we're hearing, right? Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles. Beverly Lee of the Shirelles, born on this day in 1941. Happy birthday, Beverly Lee. What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're going to talk now with Judy Richardson, senior producer at Northern Light Productions, an old civil rights warrior from SNCC and more, which we'll get into. They produced this incredible documentary called Scarred Justice, The Orangeburg Massacre, 1968. And Judy Richardson, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Mark, for having me.
So this is a moment in our history, Judy Richardson, that is completely forgotten. It was forgotten then, and it's forgotten now. Talk about how you, a bit about the history of this and how you came to it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just in terms of what it was, because most people really do not know. I know you know, because you were an activist back then, but most people don't even know that this ever happened. It's the first time that that police opened fire on an American campus. It happened 2 years before Kent State. It's 1968. And students of two historically black colleges in Orangeburg, South Carolina, Claflin University and South Carolina State, they had been protesting over a period of a couple of days a bowling alley that had a whites-only policy. And it was a bowling alley that was only 5 minutes from both colleges, two historically black colleges. And so over the period of 4 days, it kind of things escalate. The students are basically locked down on campus, and this is Thursday night, February 8th, 1968. And so sometime in the night, they build a bonfire, you know, as students will. And they're building a bonfire, and they're singing songs and freedom songs. And you hear in our interviews, you hear the young people then talk about it. And they're also shouting, you know, nasty things at the police. But at that point, you have 450 armed police in the town of Orangeburg. You had a number, about 120, that are lined up in front of the, right in the area of the of South Carolina State, which is where the bonfire was. They put the bonfire out, and then somewhere around 10:30 p.m., they don't know who gave the order or if an order was given, but shots opened fire from the state police, and at the end of that was firing of about, they think about 8 seconds. Three of the students are killed, and about at least 28 are wounded.
Right.
And so then they start rushing them to the segregated hospital. A number are rushed to Columbia, so we don't really know whether it was only 28, because they know that it's a segregated hospital in Orangeburg, so they go to Columbia. Some of the faculty at South Carolina State rush them to the hospital. So this only really comes to light because of two white Southern journalists, Jack Bass and Jack Nelson, in terms of trying to really bring this to a more national understanding. And Jack Nelson, who was then the Washington bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times, goes in, and he's from the L.A. Times Washington bureau. So he says to the hospital staff, "Well, you know, I'd like to see who was shot. I'm from the bureau." And they say, "Well, you know, we can't really do that." And he says, "Well, cover because of privacy issues." And he says, "Well, just cover it up. Cover up the names." And so what he finds is that all of those students were shot either in the back or in the thigh as they were fleeing on their own campus. But the reason that it doesn't get out is because of how the state of South Carolina and then Governor McNair frames the incident. And they say immediately the students were charging at the police, and meaning the state highway police, and that they were shooting at them, and so that the law enforcement were only protecting themselves. Now, of course, the FBI subsequently finds that there were no shots. There was no evidence of any shots being fired from campus. But in any event, the only thing that happens is they have a trial of the police officers. All of them are set for. They are never convicted. even though Attorney General Ramsey Clark at the time, he is U.S. Attorney General, he immediately orders an investigation because he says there has been a clear abuse of power. However, he can't get any South Carolina grand jury to indict. When they go to trial, he can't get a conviction of the police. And it's the only person ever convicted of anything is Cleveland Sellers, who had just returned from having worked with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the South in Mississippi and Alabama, doing voter registration work. He comes back to his hometown of Orangeburg because he grew up 15 minutes away in Denmark. They call him an outside agitator. His thing is, I don't even want to, you know, he's trying to build black consciousness groups on the campuses of the University of South Carolina and the two black campuses. His mother had gone to South Carolina State, so he knew the area. But his thing is, he's trying to build black consciousness groups to talk about the history and the responsibility of black colleges. And meanwhile, some other students are trying to do this, you know, integrating a bowling alley. And his thing is, that's not important. But he is the one who is put on trial, and he is the one who gets 7 months. And he is the one who it takes 24 years to get a pardon for. And then he becomes chairman of, I'm giving away the story. I'm hoping people see the film.
Well, they will see the film. Let's talk a bit about that. I mean, you open this film, and we can piece some of this together because I think it's important for people to hear it. I mean, it's
okay.
I mean, even in the 60s, with all the tumult and the revolution in the streets and organizing going on in the 60s in America against the war and against racism and where all this began, you have Kent State University, where 4 students were shot down by the National Guard and made famous by the song 4 Dead in Ohio, and everybody kind of it changed the nature of campuses and the anti-war movement because of that killing, those killings. But here we have, before that, and before any of the killings at Mississippi State, the Orangeburg Massacre in 1968, where 3 black students were killed and at least 28 more shot in the back and the side by National Guardsmen and State Police of South Carolina. And nobody, A, remembers it now, but even then, it was swept under the rug and nobody talked about it, and it was just put down as just another black rebellion, and we had to put these people down. And it was forgotten.
That's right. Because of the way that the state of South Carolina is allowed to frame it. Because it is. You are absolutely right. The people, I think, forget how frightened folks were. Some black people and certainly the white community was afraid because they saw black power, which had just been uttered 2 years before, as violent. And, of course, when SNCC, you know, talks about black power, they don't think it's going to be any kind of, you know, revelation, because that's what we had been doing all this time, you know, trying to create a sense of power within the African-American community at a number of levels so that we could come to the table with some sense of power that people would have to listen to in the same way every other community had done it, you know. Mm-hmm. So we don't understand why this humongous reaction against this call for, now what we're saying is black power, okay? So it's 2 years after that call, and people are thinking, oh, this means violence. That has nothing to do with what we were talking about. However, they are allowed to do that, and, of course, the rebellions are going on in the cities. We have somebody in the film who says, you know, what they were worried about was, is, you know, Detroit going to come to Orangeburg? You know, so they locked down the students right after, during the demonstrations, the night of the massacre. They have cordoned them off because, as one of our interviewees says, the white administration in Orangeburg is afraid these folks are going to come and poison the water supply. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really that serious. They're going to, you know, it's. I mean, part of it is the, you know, old slave rebellion kind of mentality, and particularly this is South Carolina. So, you know, you get that, you know, the black hordes are going to come and, you know, overwhelm us. So that is what is operative. And because the state of South Carolina is at that time seen as a more moderate
state. The governor was seen as more moderate.
Yeah, in the context of Mississippi and Alabama. You know, they don't have Volconner doing hoses then. And Governor McNair at that time was slated to be the vice presidential nominee for Humphrey, who they thought was going to win the Democratic nomination.
Right.
So, and he loses his chance because of this and does not realize it until the night of the Democratic convention, when he goes and thinks that he's going to get the nomination, and only finds out like an hour before he goes to the convention that he's not being put up as the VP nominee. Because he thinks he's done the right thing. He thinks, because white people in South Carolina think this, that he has done this wonderful thing protecting the white community from these marauding black hordes.
And it, what's amazing, this also is described in the very beginning of the film, Orangeburg, South Carolina is an area where blacks were in a majority and whites were a minority, even though whites ran it, which is it was pretty remarkable. And the strength of the black community in that area, standing up in the face of that, was pretty amazing.
It was. And the thing is, they had a history of protest. I mean, the black community had done boycotts around segregated facilities. The two schools, the students from there, had done a number of demonstrations in the early 60s. There had been major demonstrations in Rock Hill, South Carolina, earlier in the 60s. But it's also good to understand that this is not just a Southern attitude. Because I was reading this thing, they had this wonderful chart in the Times, December 20th of last year, and they talked about the way we were 1968. And
right.
They have a section called White Views of Negroes. And this is national. And they said 67% of whites believe that Negroes, as they say, are asking for more than they are ready for. 63% nationally think that Negroes have less ambition than whites. 44% think that Negroes have less native intelligence than whites.
Mm-hmm.
This is a national sense of the black community. So that's the other reason that when the state of South Carolina puts this thing out, you know, they're charging, they have the guns, that people believe them. Now, the New York Times does good coverage, but then that drops away. And certainly the L.A. Times does wonderful coverage because of Jack Bass. And the Charlotte News and Observer does good coverage because,
Jack Nelson.
The L.A. Times, right. And then Jack Bass because of the North Carolina News and Observer, where he's the bureau chief. But other than that, nobody's doing it. And the initial report that goes out is from the AP, which then, of course, sent to all the national newspapers. And that first report says that the students were shooting. Now, the photographer who sent in the report says himself, I did not say that. I never saw anybody shooting. But it never gets corrected.
In this film that you've produced, and by the way, we're talking to Judy Richardson, the film we're talking about is a documentary called Scarred Justice, The Orangeburg Massacre, 1968, a little-known piece of our modern American history that was very profound at that moment. And it will be revealed in this film. And we're talking to its senior producer from Northern Light Productions, Judy Richardson, at this moment. In the film, I mean, what comes out in this film also is the FBI cover-up, the role that the police played in covering this up. I mean, the lies that were told, and those lies directly affecting the life of Cleveland Sellers, SNCC activist, who came back to his home, as you talked about earlier, in Orangeburg, North Carolina, and was convicted and put in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And railroaded. I mean, this was so emblematic of what really happened in that period of time that people just don't realize how many people in this country were railroaded and put in prison and how much the FBI and police lied and how important it is for this story to kind of come to the fore now.
That's right. And I will say I was afraid I'd give it away, but people need to know. I mean, when you see Cleve and you see him getting arrested, I mean, what happens is that years later when he is finally pardoned, he then becomes chair of African American studies at the university, previously segregated, right, University of South Carolina, and is now the current president of Voorhees College in his hometown of Denmark, South Carolina. His son, Bakari Sellers, at 21 years old, became the youngest state senator, a state representative, in all of South Carolina's history.
Right.
And it's just amazing guy who introduced President Obama when he was down in South Carolina during the campaign.
I discovered him. He was featured in Gwen Ifill's book.
Oh, yes, wasn't he? That's right.
Right. As one of the up-and-coming young African-American political figures, Bakari Sellers. There's a very moving point in that, in your film, when he speaks to a crowd and tries to show the power of that moment by counting down the seconds that it took for these shots to be fired, and then could not maintain his composure.
It's amazing.
That was a pretty powerful. What was also very stunning to me was the half-hearted attempt at truth and reconciliation that you show in the film. And there's a little piece in there with Fritz Hollings, who says, tells the guy in the audience that it's really irrelevant to talk about if these were white students who would have done something. That was pretty amazing.
Yes, because in fact, that's Jack Bass, the co-editor, the co-author with Jack Nelson of the seminal book on this called the Orangeburg Massacre. And when Jack Bass says, "Do you think that this would have been covered up if this had happened on," he didn't say all white, but basically all white, Clemson University. And when Fritz Hollings, you are right, when Fritz Hollings says, "Oh, come on now, might as well say the Citadel," and of course everybody thinks, uh-huh, same thing, you know. But no, it is a wonderful scene. But we shot a lot of, you know, we started doing this, Northern Lights started doing this, several years ago. When I came on full-time staff, it was 2001, and Bester Cram, the founder and head of Northern Light Productions, because Northern Light has been around since 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I come on board, he says, "I got a project I think you'd be interested in." He doesn't think I know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh, my goodness, Orangeburg, I just got some clippings from Cleve Sellers and Bitter." So we're going through this, and I did not know Cleve that well at that point. But it's clearly a good story. But we shot on Northern Light's dime for at least 6 years before we got funding from ITVF and then from National Black Programming Consortium, both of which are funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. But before that happened, we got that funding in December of 2006. And I was I screamed. I ran into Bester's office. He was on the phone. I ran back. I did a sign, which is still sitting up on my bookshelf, that said, it says, "ITVF approved." And so I ran back. He's off the phone, but I'm still holding the sign. We did high fives. We jumped up and down. I mean, it was like, finally, you know, after how many shoots in South Carolina, how much money has been spent on this, on Northern Lights, you know, we had no funding for this. And then luckily, ITVS understood it, and National Black Programming understood. And so we were able to do more filming. But that Citadel shot, there was a civil rights conference at the Citadel in 2003, and that's where you see that scene that you mentioned with Fritz Holling and then the lieutenant governor, West.
Right.
It's a absolutely revealing film.
I think one of the things that was so nice, some of the contextual aspects of the film, too, because it was a very sensitive job was done to kind of show the contradictions, but also the humanity, or the human feeling, I should say, on the parts of the white state troopers.
Mm-hmm.
And their conversations about this. And their being part of that moment and being defined by that moment was really very clearly shown in the film.
Oh, I'm so glad you got that. Because, you know, I was prepared not to like them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then Bester did those interviews, the two of those. And you come back and you look at them and you think, particularly the one who shot.
The corporal.
Lanier.
Right.
Lanier. That's right, the officer who shot. You see that he knows, you know, and he's older. And it's just, it's hard. You know, you can tell that it's hard for him. And the same, but to a lesser extent, for the younger officer who, you know, looks older, but I mean was younger then, who did not shoot. But it's Lanier, I think, who really touches you. And you do. You see their humanity.
So it wasn't intended, but that was a consequence of this film.
I think so. And what's interesting is that I think people got more in touch with that, with the massacre by talking about it. I know it was interesting, the current mayor of Orangeburg, who is an older white man, looks somewhat like the mayor who's in the archival footage.
Right, right. Uh-huh.
Yeah. and And so he was prepared not to like the film, wanted to see a screening beforehand. And he sees it. And when we see him, he spoke at the 41st annual commemoration. I mean, they've had a commemoration every year for 41 years of this event, this tragedy. And so we went and we premiered the film on February 8th at the 41st annual commemoration. The mayor spoke, as did a prominent white minister who gave the invocation, and the editor, the white editor of the Orangeburg Daily newspaper, who's a very good person, too. But in any event, the mayor, the current mayor, apologized for Tuesday night, which is the night that the city officers, the Orangeburg officers, beat the students, and particularly the women, which is what really sets the students
off. At the bowling alley demonstration.
At the bowling alley demonstration 2 days before the massacre. And so they are trying to integrate, and the police just kind of go off, and they start beating the students. And what really makes the students mad, particularly the male students, is to see their female counterparts being beaten in this way. Well, the mayor, at this commemoration on February 8th, apologized for Tuesday night and says to us afterwards that it was his apology was as a result of having seen the film. Now, I will say, I'm thinking to myself, you didn't apologize Thursday night, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, shoot, you know, you could have just said, well, you know, it wasn't the city responsibility, but, you know, as a South Carolinian, I also apologize. I said this to Cleve Sellers, who was the one arrested, you know, who is still in South Carolina, of course, and he said to me laughingly, he says, boy, you Northerners, you don't even understand. He said, this was a 180-degree turn for this man. And I thought, okay, you know, and Jack Bass, also a Southerner, said the same thing. You know, this is a real turn for him. You know, so it's okay, I'm wrong, yeah.
Given that, and you finished this film, and when you reflect on it now, the significance of this film for people to see at this moment.
Well, I think, first of all, it's the smaller universe, and that's in terms of the effect it's having in Orangeburg. I mean, that it has really made, created a vehicle through which they can talk about this, because it wasn't just the white community that wanted to paper it over. It was the black community, some of whom also believed that the students had shot and believed, well, yes, it was an overreaction by the police, but thought that there was some reason that the police had shot. Now, no, that was not true. And so there, a lot of it is the discussion that's going on there, and just, I mean, it was 700 people who were in that premiere who suddenly rose up in clumps and gave us a standing ovation. It was the families of the three who had been shot. It was the survivors and their families and a number of other community people. And I just broke out and cried, you know, on the way back to the podium. So it's within the community there is having one thing. But it's and one young woman who is a senior at South Carolina State who said, you know, I never really knew what happened. She said my family would talk about it, would refer to it, but it was almost like, you know, I would get little pieces. Nobody really explained what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
She said, this is the first time I understand what happened. And she lives in Orangeburg. But what it does nationally is to show what happens when you have such an unbridled abuse of power. I mean, in my own mind, I'm hoping people see what we did in Guantanamo. What we did, you know, it's all of that. What happens when you don't have any accounting for a clear abuse of power? And what happens when you see what people think they can do to people if they are the other? Because what Governor McNair decided was, these are not like the black students whom I negotiated with the year before. In 1967, he had helped them get rid of the president at South Carolina State, who was not very good.
Mm-hmm.
He had worked with them. But he now decides, this is black power time. Cleve Sellers is a friend of Stokely Carmichael who uttered black power. They are the other now. And so he doesn't think that he can talk to them. In fact, a lot of them are the same students. In fact, Cleve didn't even want to do the bowling alley. You know, so it is this the way that they misrepresent, because for the state administration, these are now the others. But what you also see is the role of young people, and that's crucial.
It is crucial, and I this is a marvelous documentary.
Thank you, Mark, and I know you're the voice of the community, so thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. On the way to break, Have You Seen Your Mother, Baby, Standing in the Shadow by the Rolling Stones, recorded on this day in 1966.